went into Geordie Shore thinking I knew it all and I had it all figured out and I was big and I was brave and I was strong and I was loud and I was all those things, and actually I just wasn't. The person I became, that version of Vicky on that show, became like me armour.
Let's say we can get labelled by the outside world as something and then we become more of that thing because we identify with it.
I just hate that we're so cruel to ourselves as women. Eat the pizza, drink the cocktail, kiss the boy, book the flight, whatever it is, and stop being in pursuit of some unattainable goal.
Oh my God, I honestly think I need to like clap that, because if you were on a stage right now, I think you'd have a standing ovation.
No one is going to stand up at your funeral and say, she looked so good in a bikini. Nobody's going to.
I'm going to share something I've never shared before.
Deepfake AI abuse. It's the latest iteration in violence against women.
They demonized me for something that was not in my control. Welcome back to Rise with Roxy. Today's guest is someone you may think you already know, but the woman joining us now is a world away from the Vicky Patterson we first met on Geordie Shore. From reality TV wild child to author, podcaster, mental health advocate, and businesswoman, Vicky has been on one hell of a journey. She's tackled everything from addiction and body image to deep fake abuse and the toxic side of fame. And she's done it with brutal honesty and incredible growth. On this episode of Rise with Roxy, we're asking, how do you rise when the world tells you you can't? Let's find out with Vicky Patterson. Vicky, thank you so much for coming. I've been so excited to see you.
Honestly, Roxy, I'm so sorry, because I feel like I've let you down so many times for this part, and I know it's been difficult, but I've even getting this date in, I was like, we cannot cancel on Roxy again. I was like, her team have been so great. She's been so patient. And I just really wanted to say, yeah. Aww. So I'm so grateful you've been so flexible with, because I know how busy you are.
No, don't be silly. I'm so grateful. And you were at the BAFTAs last night.
I was, yeah.
How was it?
I think I'm just a bit like long in the tooth for everything. Like,
right.
I'm on the slope to 40, the downhill slope to 40, or uphill, however you look at it. Mm-hmm. And got married last year. Like, I just think I really love me little quiet life with me husband and my dogs and stuff. And not that the BAFTAs isn't a brilliant excuse to get out of the house, it is, but I was just craving a bit of normality yesterday. You're getting ready from like 9 o'clock in the morning.
Jeez, from 9 a.m.
Well, the red carpet opens from 2.
Let's have a little rundown of what, because do you know what? I think we see all these events on the internet and you see the glam photos, but I think it'd be so nice to lift the lid on like the reality, not in any kind of like ungrateful way, but like what actually goes into all of this? Like, how much effort and energy and people does it take to get that fab picture?
Oh, it takes a village. Like, and I'm really transparent, so like, but there's probably everyone's seen the photos of me, you know, when I'm tired or hungover or hormonal or whatever. So they know what it takes to get me looking like BAFTAs ready. So it's an early carpet for starters, and it's always the hottest day of the year.
Always.
So yesterday I was like dripping like an egg sandwich on that red carpet. Like, you can just feel the sweat going down your legs. It's really an uncomfortable scenario, but you've got to be there for about 2. So for me, it requires, of course, you spray tan the night before, and then you're up about 9:10 in the morning. Glam team arrive, because you need about 2 hours in glam, then need an hour getting like in your dress, getting all your jewellery, getting ready. Little half an hour window just in case there's any mistakes or anybody's late. And then you need to do your content, which I think itself has just become such a big beast.
Yeah.
It just used to be like you posted your carpet, your picture from the red carpet.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone was dead excited. But now you need your photographer and your content creator, and you need to do something different and blah, blah, blah. So honestly, I was getting ready from about 9 o'clock in the morning. I got on the carpet about 3.
Wow.
Home for 6 o'clock. Don't tell anyone.
Oh, you were home at 6. Heaven.
Yeah.
Heaven.
There's 27 awards, and like, when you're not nominated for anything, you may as well be sitting on the other side of the fucking Thames, Roxy. Like, me, you went so far back. And I was like, who's that? Is that Rylan? Like, trying my hardest. But it was lovely. And I do love telly, so it was great to see some of the shows I'd watched get the recognition they deserved. But yeah, by about 6 o'clock, my eyelids were just closing, and I was like, that to irk. I was like, should we go back?
Yeah.
Get our PJs on and get room service.
Sorry, that is the best feeling.
It was amazing.
When you've made that decision to go and you're on your way out and you're like, oh my God, get me to my bed.
I know. And I always bump into someone else as well, you know, trying to do the old Irish goodbye, Roxy. Yeah. Like it was Anna Williamson last year, Christine McGuinness this year. And we're always just like, want to get back to our kids and our dogs. And it's such an honour and such a lovely thing and an amazing moment for those nominated and those receiving awards. But yeah, like I do feel like, I don't know how many years I've got left in us going because I am, in me core, just a bit of a homebody.
Yeah. Yeah. I so get that. I mean, I love staying in. I feel like the whole getting like a nice piece of content is like addictive. So you want the high from it because it's like, it is nice to like feel fab.
Yeah.
But actually, in reality, at the time, you quite often just wish you were in your pajamas.
No, that's a real insightful observation there, mate. Like, I think Instagram is addictive.
Yeah.
Like all social media is, you know, you've got to make sure you're not too beholden to these pretty little squares and you are living the life you want to live. So no, I think we made the right decision for us yesterday.
Good.
Got a pic, saw some fabulous people, celebrated those who deserved celebrating, and then ate cheeseburgers in bed.
Oh, dream, dream. Right, well, I'm sure we're going to talk more about Instagram later. Probably. But I want to now go right back because most people will know you from your early days in Geordie Shore.
My previous work.
Your previous, another lifetime, really. Another lifetime.
15 years ago, Roxy.
Shit.
I know. I know.
Wow.
It always shocks everyone, which I take as like a huge compliment. Yeah. Obviously, the injectables are working.
Oh, I mean, thank fuck for Botox, let's be honest. Right. So looking back, you've said before that was like some of the hardest times of your life.
Yeah.
And what do you think emotionally was going on for you at that time?
I just want to like almost like preface this by saying this is absolutely just my experience with Geordie Shore. I know fans of the show and, you know, other cast members that they're still very precious and very protective of it. And that's understandably so. It means different things to different people.
For sure.
But this is my experience. I don't want to upset anybody. I was 21 when I was found for Geordie Shore. I'd just finished uni. I was a little bit lost, didn't know what I was doing with myself. I really believed I was going to graduate from uni and it was going to be like one of those rom-coms where somebody comes storming over and's like, offers you a job. You're just what our company's looking for. And of course, it's like not like that at all. Such a romanticized version of it. So I had to go back to Newcastle from Liverpool with my tail between my legs with no job. I ended up working back in bars and nightclubs, mate. And that's where I got found for it, right? So I was, even before Geordie Shore, partying quite a lot,
right.
Not really sure what I was doing with myself and just felt like, I say, a little bit lost.
Mm-hmm.
I've always had, and I didn't know it at the time, but a complicated relationship with alcohol.
Mm.
My dad is an alcoholic, which is something I've talked about really openly, mm-hmm. made a documentary with Channel 4 about it. I understand it better now, but at the time I didn't.
Mm.
Do we even understand anything in our 20s?
Yeah.
Like,
God.
I look back and I thought I was so grown up and like I'd done summers in Ibiza, so I was so cosmopolitan. Like, I was a fetus. Like, I was an absolute fetus. Like, I knew nothing about anything. And I suppose that youthful arrogance, like, it pushes you out of comfort zone, makes you do brilliant things. Like, I'm not knocking it at all. Mm. I'm a nervous wreck in my 30s. I love that I was brave in my 20s. But yeah, I definitely think it gave me a false sense of security. And I went into Geordie Shore thinking I knew it all and I had it all figured out and I was big and I was brave and I was strong and I was loud and I was all those things, and actually I just wasn't.
Mm.
And I think what I experienced on that show and what people saw was like quite a lost little girl who definitely didn't have the tools to navigate the space she was in, who wasn't a nice drunk, who had a very difficult relationship with alcohol, who was dealing with a lot of stuff behind the scenes that she didn't know how to deal with. And an amalgamation of those things led that time to be very difficult and very traumatic for me.
Mm.
It was controversial car crash TV, wasn't it? Mm. They didn't want we all sitting around looking gorgeous and glamorous and talking about weather jazzles. We were real, we were raw, we were at times quite terrifying. And I think we tick those boxes, but for me, it was certainly at the detriment of my mental health.
I think sometimes, let's say we can get labelled by the outside world as something, and then we become more of that thing because we identify with it. How much do you think that was happening to you at the time? Like, do you think it exacerbated your relationship with alcohol?
Absolutely. Like, I think it would be very easy for me to sit here and say to you, oh, you know, I've got a terrible edit and producers and manipulation and this, that and the other and blah, blah, blah. And I'm not saying there's not an element of that, but there has to be some accountability here, Roxy.
Of course.
I was probably on that trajectory regardless.
Interesting.
I was. I came from quite a rough place in Newcastle.
Mm-hmm.
I was quite rough myself. Mm-hmm. And I'm still not ashamed of that, you know.
No.
But I definitely had a lot of growing up to do, right? So I'm not going to blame anyone or anything like that. But what I will say is that I don't think there was necessarily the support there for young people who were experiencing the things we were in the public eye for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a shame. I'm so grateful now that there does seem to have been improvements within that space and a better duty of care and things like that. It took extreme tragedy to get there and it came far too late, but I am pleased there's progression. But for me, I don't want to blame anyone else or anything. Mm. I want to own it. But I think it's important to acknowledge, right, that if you're told enough that you are like a monster or you are aggressive or you are a slag or any of the horrible things that we were told we were on TV, ugly, fat, whatever. I hate saying these things out loud. I hate it. I hate giving them airtime. But if you're told those things over and over again, like you're just human, you will absorb it. You will believe it.
Yeah.
And I had such low self-worth at that time because of, you know, the noise surrounding the show and all the rest of it. And me as a character on it, me as a person, that I think I doubled down out of like spite, out of, you know, just anger. I was like, I don't care. I'm not bothered. This is who I am. Fuck them, which is absolutely not who I am. I'm so sensitive. Yeah. So I became this like caricature of myself. Mm. The person I became, that version of Vicky on that show became like me armor.
Right.
Roxy.
Yeah.
And it was like, if I'm strong and if I'm loud, nobody can hurt me and these words can't hurt me. But actually they were destroying us from the inside out.
Yeah.
And I was becoming less and less and like myself and more like a caricature. And it's quite a slippery slope, that.
And it makes so much sense. Like, you can completely understand why you would need that armor. I don't know how I would cope. And I think it's no surprise that you had to find a way to protect yourself. And if that meant having this armor, then that was just your survival mechanism at the time.
Yeah.
But when was the point that you realized, like, I have to walk away? What was there a turning point, or was it just a gradual decision?
I used to say at the start of every new series, I'm not coming back, I'm not coming back. And like, had I been a bit more shrewd or something, it might have been a technique to get more money, or maybe it wasn't. I just didn't want to go. And I really believed I didn't want to go, but I didn't have anything else. You know, all these amazing like brand deals and other opportunities, and they weren't very forthcoming.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, like, I felt really trapped. So I stayed for a lot longer than I should have.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think there was an element that the people around us needed me to stay small and needed me to stay there. So, you know, I was repeatedly told there was nothing else for me. And I think there was a couple moments that were like turning points. Like, I was getting into my late 20s and I wanted the things that girls start to want in their late 20s, like a nice fella. I wanted to like wake up in a bed with like just me in the room, not like I was at some fucking sort of like summer camp with loads of lasses, you know? I just wanted a normal home life, and keeping up with the popularity of the show was difficult. The more people seemed to consume it, the more MTV wanted to make. And it got to the point where we're doing 3 series a year, and that's, say, 6 to 8 months of your year.
Mm.
And it sounds like nothing. And I just want to go on record and say, I know I definitely wasn't down the mines. I was drinking on TV, but I just was losing so much of myself. And I think I got to about 27, must have been, and I was reading a book. I'd come home early from a night out, Roxy, right? And I was reading a book and I had like a little face mask on and they were all still out having a lovely time because the cast are younger than me as well, you know. Right. I am an old boot. certainly in terms of reality TV, I'm an old boot. So yeah, so I'd come home and I remember this like runner like frantically rushing up the stairs and being like, I found her, I've got eyes on Vicky. And they were like, yeah, she's in bed with a book. And it was the like, it's just... utter, like, his incredulous reaction, like, couldn't believe I was reading a book and, you know, he was like, can you, they're about to come back from the night out. Can you just put that away because it's not on brand?
Oh my God.
And I thought, it's not on brand. Like, I don't know. I think there'd been a lot of things building up to that moment, as I mentioned, but that was a real pivotal moment for me. I remember thinking, no, I can't push this narrative. Mm-hmm. Women are multifaceted. We're brilliant. We're brave, strong, sassy. We can drink in a bar and also want to read a book.
Yes.
Those things, they can coexist. And I left without else, Roxy, you know. Like, I didn't have the promise of something else. I didn't have, like, money in the bank. Like, mm-hmm. I just knew my time was done. And I knew I was never going to be a person I was proud of. I wanted to be when I was still living in my unhappiness.
Mm. I think that's a really sort of inspiring lesson for people, because I think a lot of people stay stuck where they are because they're so afraid of what's on the other side or what might not be on the other side. And actually, if you are in a place, like sometimes I say you don't even need to be going towards something. Sometimes it's just being going away from something. So for you, it was going away from unhappiness, from the person that you don't want to be or the person that you thought you were becoming there. And I think that was as much of a motive, because even if you don't know what's coming, it's going to be better than staying stuck where you are.
It's like a leap of faith, isn't it, man? Over the years, like, I've done loads of work on myself. I've got this one brilliant life coach. He's a lovely fella. And he described it as like, your comfort zone, like, you're living on an island, aren't you? And like, you're in that comfort zone and you know where everything is and you know where the coconuts are and your little island is fine, but it is just a little island. Mm. And in the distance, you think you can see something and it looks like it could be a bigger island and you don't know if there's like better fish there or better coconuts or, you know, that island could be great. You just don't know. So you start swimming because you're excited and there's this hope of possibility in a new life and a better you and all the things you think you deserve and want. And then it gets dark and it gets stormy and things get hard. And there's like a huge portion of people who turn around at that point and go back to the island that they know. But he's like, what makes you different is when you push on.
God, I love this analogy.
Isn't it nice?
Yes.
And you go into the unknown and you explore the new island. And honestly, it's always better at the new one. It's always so much better. And for years, when things got hard, I went back.
Mm.
I did. I reverted to old habits and old ways and self-sabotage and stayed on the island that I knew. But no, in that moment, I knew I had to get out and I knew I had to do something more. And I'm so grateful. I don't know where that bravery came from because I don't do a lot of it these days. I'm so bad at pushing myself out of my comfort zone now, but I think that's because I'm really content. But I'm so proud of that version, of that little Vicky who did that.
I'm proud of you too.
Thank you.
So how did your relationship with alcohol change over those kind of years and the years to come?
That's quite a difficult one to unpack. And again, I would love to be able to say, you know, I left Geordie Shore and I just fucking love J2Os. It's just not realistic, is it? Like, I genuinely believe there's a huge genetic element to addiction and alcohol and also essentially a bit of a learned behaviour element as well. I continue to struggle with that, I think, for the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And what did struggling look like for you?
Alcohol to me has always been deeply linked to emotion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an emotional everything, actually, if the truth be told. So, like, I'm an emotional eater, I'm an emotional drinker, like, everything, you know? And I am addictive.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to go to the gym, I have to go every day.
Right.
If I'm going to work, I have to work every hour God sends. Like, if I'm going to do nothing, I have to lie. Do you know what I mean? I'm a person of extremes, which I'm working on, but it's a difficult one. So, yeah, so I left Geordie Shore around 27 and, you know, just started to try and find what my life looked like outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
I found an incredible agent, all female team, which really made a difference to me. I felt safe. I felt protected. I felt understood for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
They sent me to therapy. It's one of the first things they did.
Amazing.
Tricked us. Just wanted to let you know.
What happened?
It was just before I was due to go in the jungle. And there's these incredible people. They're called the Speakmans. And I credit so much of, you know, my happiness to them.
Yeah.
And they actually are more famous for phobia fighting. They help people, you know, who have extreme anxieties or fears of things, or in fact, phobias, overcome them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was scared of cockroaches and spiders before I went in the jungle. And they were like, they're going to help you. They're going to help you cure you of this, understand it, blah, 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 and everything. I was like, oh, amazing. I quickly realised I was there for other things.
Right.
They helped us understand a lot, you know, about why I drink. And like, they helped us understand my dad's illness as well, which in turn sort of made me, you know, lit a spark in my head, which made me sort of think, maybe I'm on that slippery slope as well. So I started to learn to understand it. But when you have addictive tendencies, it's just not that easy. You can understand it, but you can still want it, you know?
Of course.
You can know, like, if I go out at night and do X, Y, and Z, I know I'm going to argue with people I love. I'm going to affect working relationships. I'm going to not be my best tomorrow. I'm going to do this. I'm going to feel rubbish, my anxiety, blah, blah, blah. Just, you can't stop it. So it was a bit of a long journey that, and one actually I think I'm still understanding, as I think anybody with addiction issues or tendencies or anything like that will tell you, like, it's kind of a lifelong thing. But no, I'm in a much better place. And I think that's come a little bit with age, a little bit with Erkan, and a little bit with, you know, being happy with myself and all the rest of it, but mostly with just understanding the reasons why I drank.
So what's your relationship with it now?
So I can have a couple of drinks, Roxy.
Nice.
I know.
Amazing.
And like, that was never me. I was like, all or nothing, balls to the wall, last one standing. Yeah. And obviously, as you know, last night I was home at 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
So it's really lovely to be able to sit here and say that to you earnestly. Yeah. Because I know a lot of people actually don't get to say that. But I do sometimes still live in fear, mate. That just my dad's daughter. And no matter how healed or well or anything I think I am, it's still, there's still something there, you know? So yeah, there's always a, and I actually think that fear keeps me right. I always cry.
I think it's always incredible to see such raw emotion come out so readily. And I think it's because it's a reminder that our subconscious is always there with our stored memories, our stored emotions, and it just sometimes needs tapping into to process, to let go, to offer ourselves compassion. I think there's something so healing about it, and it's really nice to recognize when we're still touching on something that's raw and a wound that is still there, but we can support it, you know, and you have the tools to support it.
I think I'll always cry when I talk about my dad, my relationship with alcohol, his illness and everything. And I don't know, I used to hate that I was such a crier, Roxy. I used to be so upset, probably, you know, the whole armor thing again. But like, now I've just realized it's like my vulnerability, my sensitivity, it's such a huge part of who I am.
Absolutely. And it's something to be so proud of. It's how, why people connect with you so well, because you are vulnerable and open. And it's so, I think it's incredible. You know, it's funny. I think sometimes the things that we think are our weaknesses are actually our superpowers. Like, they're the things that make us so unique and magnetic. And before we move on, I just want to say, how was the filming the documentary about your dad for you? How was that experience? Because it was such a huge thing to do. What was it like for you, and what was it like for your relationship with your dad?
It was an incredibly cathartic process. So I sort of mentioned before that when I was younger, I definitely didn't understand my dad's illness.
But were you aware he had a problem?
My mom did her best to shield myself and my sister from an awful lot of the, I'll say, like, spicier moments of his illness. She did a really good job, my mum. She's an amazing woman. But kids see and hear an awful lot more than anyone gives them credit for. Mm. We were just aware, me and my sister, you know, and it definitely shapes who you become as an adult. I do a lot of apologising. I do a lot of, like, trying to make everybody happy. I do a lot of people pleasing, you know. Mm. And that's a very common trait of the child of an addict or an alcoholic.
Interesting.
You're very scared to rock the boat. You're trying desperately to make everyone happy, so you're not the catalyst for an argument or a fight or a fallout or anything like that. So I carried a lot of resentment for me dad. Mm-hmm. But then also a lot of love as well, mate. It was a mad one. It was very conflicting feeling. There's a vulnerability. You want to protect them. You want to enable them. Whatever your version of that looks like, you get that. So I had done it all with my dad over the years. And then when this documentary, the opportunity came up, he was just really adamant that he wanted to help people who'd been in the position he was. Mm. And I really wanted to help people who'd been in the position I was. So children of alcoholics, any relatives of alcoholics, he wanted to help people struggling with the illness. So we both went in with like real passion, real goals. I think a real open heart, basically. And that's what you need if you're going to do something like that, like autobiographical docs, like you have to just be real, give everybody everything. And we did, and it was a hard one because you're showing so much of yourself. And also as well, like I'm used to everyone knowing my story. I'm used to everyone knowing, thinking they know everything about me. But this was me dad's story to tell. So I felt very protective. But over the course of like, I think we made it for about 3-4 months, I learned to understand him and his illness so much more. And even after the years of therapy and life coaching and counselling and everything, I don't think I ever would have been able to exercise the level of compassion and understanding I've got for my dad. And for alcoholics and addicts in general, if I hadn't done that project, these people are ill. And if he could have been any different, I know he would have been. I think we did what we set out to do, and I'm really proud of it. And it made mine and my dad's relationship so much stronger. He comes to stay with me in Erkan now. Aww. His recovery isn't going to be linear, Roxy. Yeah. There's going to be highs and lows, and I'm dead supportive of that. But ultimately, no, I brought me and my dad closer, I think, and that to me is a win.
Oh, that is honestly so, so beautiful. And thank you so much for sharing. I do believe that we go through things in life so that we can help other people. And for you and your dad both to do that, I think is incredible. And for that relationship to heal in such an amazing way is just an incredible cherry on top of everything else that show did for others. Because I think so many of us have people in our lives that perhaps we resent or we feel angry with or we blame. And actually, the best way to counteract those emotions are to find compassion. And compassion can only come with true understanding. And so again, I think it's such a great lesson for people that if they have those people in their lives, how can they find a way to understand them better? And in that understanding comes such, I mean, you must have felt like a weight was lifted when that resentment turned to compassion.
No, honestly, it did. And I didn't realise how much anger I'd been walking around with, you know? That feeling of not understanding and that resentment, it manifested itself in some awful ways when I was younger, and I was aggressive and I was loud and I was violent and all those things. But, like, understanding my dad's illness, letting go, forgiving him, compassion, like you say, it just, honestly, I attribute it a big amount to the person I'm becoming now, because I couldn't have been able to love Erkan, you know. Erkan certainly wouldn't have been able to love me if I was still that like unhealed version of me.
I really don't think anyone can truly live their most fulfilled life unless they do heal those wounds. Yeah. And so for you to say that, I think somebody listening might be thinking, maybe it's time I actually start to heal those wounds. And I think that is so amazing that you've shared that. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, mate.
So I want to go and move on to body confidence. I know you once said that you like actively hated your body before.
Yeah.
And then you've also mentioned that you actually felt shame about contributing to diet culture. So what was your kind of overarching journey? And then we can dig deeper into it.
So I was born in 1987. So I grew up in like the 90s and the early 2000s, which was just like peak diet culture. Although having said that, I don't think we'll ever truly escape the toxicity of it, you know. Mm-hmm. But for me, back in my day, it was the circle of shame in like your glossy mags and things like that, when heaven forbid a woman, a celebrity had been caught on the beach with a bit of cellulite or, you know, a tummy roll or whatever they deemed unsightly. It was like the Special K diet.
Oh my God, I did that.
Babe, everyone did that.
Best fucking marketing idea of all time.
Honestly,
here's
terrifying.
Your diet. Eat only our brand for 3 days, 3 times a day.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know any woman who didn't do it, who's like around our age. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even the whole Kate Moss, like nothing tastes as good as skinny feels. Let me tell you, you've obviously not had your laughing gear around the Profiterole Tower from Marks and Spencer's, mate. Because that's fucking brilliant. And when you're young and impressionable, like you just absorb these very loud, very clear messages. And the message was this: you are only going to be attractive and desirable and worthy of success or love or whatever it is that your heart desires if you are skinny, if you are small. And I'm very naturally curvy person. You know what I mean? Like, getting my body to fit this societal ideal wasn't easy. And it involved like extremes. So whether that was like weaponizing exercise, juice cleansers, God, like I think about all of the things I put my body through. And like probably from the age of about, I'd say 12, 13, when I became aware that I was a bit bigger than everybody else, till probably when I was late 20s, early 30s, I probably never really ordered what I wanted on a menu. I might have ate chips or pizza or whatever, but there was always a sense of guilt. There was always a sense, I'll work this off tomorrow in the gym, or I will skip breakfast, or I'll do this. It always came with this like toxic prerequisite. And I can always just remember being fucking hungry and fucking miserable. And you know, the maddest thing happened, Roxy, that when I got down to this like goal weight, I thought I'd just be so happy. And I wasn't. I hadn't found a lovely man who was going to love me for me. It didn't make my career any better. Didn't make us look in the mirror and see anything other than my insecurities any more than it had before. Didn't make us a better person. Didn't make all my trauma go away. I was just still skinny and miserable, you know? So I think in that moment, it took me getting there before I could realize, like, actually being a certain size or a certain weight or a certain number on a scale, whatever it is you're in desperate pursuit of, that isn't actually going to make you happy. What made me happy was balance. I really like cheese and I really like chocolate and I like sugary fun cocktails with things that stick out the top. And I like I like to enjoy myself with my husband. Like, he's from like a Turkish Cypriot background, mate. So like what we love so much is big meals and family time and takeaways and this, that and the other. And yes, I love getting out and walking the dogs. And yes, I love feeling nice in my clothes and being healthy and strong, but that isn't skinny. Not for me, you know? So I had to go through all these like really quite horrible, toxic things and quite fucking traumatic moments to actually understand that for me, happiness was so much more than my clothes size. I felt like for a hot moment, body positivity was winning again. Did you? I felt like we were really embracing like everybody is beautiful and everybody looks different and your body's going to change and that's okay because it's still deserving of love and all this. And I felt like that message was was louder than ever before. And then there's this whole new movement coming in now and I don't know. I've got no judgment at all, but I just think, oh, it's a bit of a shame, isn't it? But I know for me, I'll never be happy if I'm not living my life to the fullest. And that involves all the aforementioned snacks and treats.
Yeah. I find that so inspiring. And I think that it is a very powerful insight to reach the thing that you think is going to make you happy and realize it doesn't. And sometimes we have to get to that point. We have to kind of put ourselves through everything we thought we had to, only to realize, oh shit, the confidence and that joy and the happiness is actually found within. Yeah. And it's nothing on the outside is going to do that for me.
No one is going to stand up at your funeral and say, she looked so good in a bikini. Nobody's going to. Nobody's going to remember your fucking flat stomach or your thigh gap or your clothes size. They're going to say she was fun. They're going to say, like, remember that weekend in Lisbon or remember that hen do or remember that night out or... they're going to remember the way you made them feel, the way your laugh sounded. I just hate that we're so cruel to ourselves as women. And we think we should be reduced down to something as trivial as the way we look. We are strong and bright and brilliant and powerful and so much more than how we look. So if you are worrying and putting your life on hold in some desperate attempt to look a certain way, you're just going to regret it. Embrace everything life throws at you. Eat the pizza, drink the cocktail, kiss the boy, book the flight, whatever it is. Just live your life and stop being in pursuit of some fucking unattainable goal. Because they always move those goalposts about what's attractive as well.
Oh my fuck.
I'm going to cry again.
Oh my God. I honestly think I need to like clap that because... If you were on a stage right now, I think you'd have a standing ovation. That was so moving. And honestly, I have to say, in the spirit of vulnerability, I cannot tell you how much I needed to hear that. I have been so self-conscious for the last month, and I've had this really bad sun allergy or whatever the fuck it is, and I've been coming up in rashes, and I'm so swollen, and I don't look like myself.
I think you always look gorgeous.
Oh, you're so sweet. And today, usually we film the introductions before, and I was like, I can't film it today. I look too disgusting. Even though I should know better, right? And because I've written a fucking book on confidence.
But you're still just human.
You know, it still gets to me. And I'm like, oh, the pressure of being on camera is still a lot for me. And yeah. So I really needed to hear that. So thank you.
Well, in the spirit of honesty, I will tell you, I wore this dress especially for you because I thought you'd like it.
I do. And the first thing I said was how much I loved your dress and I'm going to buy it.
Like, honestly, girls can be so great and like such a lovely, like, you know, it'd be such a lovely community to each other and all the rest of it. It would be so lovely. Fuck me, honestly, though, mate. We can be our own biggest enemies as well. Yeah. The negative self-talk, it's so destructive. And I just hope, I wish you saw what I saw, Roxy.
I literally love you. I would love to talk about aging.
Oh.
Okay. So I am 35 in a couple of months.
You look great.
Thank you, Botox. And I think after my dad passed away, I started thinking about our own mortality a bit more. And because I spent, much like you, the first 30 years of my life, I was deeply unhappy. I had no self-worth. I was an addict for 10 years. I was so fucking unhappy. And I feel that in many ways, since I found confidence in who I am, since I discovered manifestation, I've really only just started to enjoy life truly fully in the last couple of years. And so I started panicking because I was like, oh my God, like I'm nearly 35 and I've only just started to enjoy life and I just want to make the most of it. And fuck, have I only started too late to like enjoy it? I've only got the hang of life. And I posted on my Instagram and I was like, look, for anybody that is older than me, can you just tell me, like, does it just keep getting better? And I had an overwhelming response. And I don't think, and there was both an overwhelming response of people who are older and were like, fuck yeah, it just gets better and better. But also a lot of people in their 30s who are like, oh my God, I'm having the same panic. And so I think this is so relevant and something that people don't really talk about. How are you feeling about it?
Honestly, I can really relate to a lot of the stuff you just said there, Roxy, like quite clearly had a real sense of self-loathing for a very long time and didn't like myself for the certainly all my 20s, you know, through like surrounding myself with the right people, through like showing up as the person I want to be and working on myself and all the rest of it. I don't hate myself anymore. I don't. I'm starting to be really proud of the woman I'm becoming. I'm more aware. And I think being accepting of yourself, the things you like, the things you don't, whatever it is, just knowing yourself comes with age. And that makes me excited. Highlights of my 30s so far have been learning to love myself, fucking giving myself some grace, like accepting myself. And all those things were so liberating. They helped us relax. They helped us meet Erkan, who is like the love of my life and the best thing that's ever happened to us. They've helped us have better friendships and better relationships with my family. They've helped us have a career I could have only dreamed of because I'm just fucking kinder to myself. If I'm on that trajectory now in my 30s, like I have to believe, based on the intel you gave me earlier and all the lovely things that my older friends or my family or my mom tells us, I know that's just going to keep getting better and better until I'm this like crazy old woman in a care home just farting because I don't care. I don't care what anyone thinks of us, and I'm so happy in my own skin. So aging is a hard one in terms of the physicality of it. We're programmed to believe we are useful when we're young and gorgeous and all the rest of it. But I think the things I've discovered that come with it far outweigh some laughter lines, mate.
Yeah.
That's not to say I don't fucking love Botox.
Yeah. God bless Botox. Oh. I think you're right. And I think, you know, when I first found out I was pregnant, when I found out, I was so, so nervous. I was terrified. And I felt...
How old were you, Roxy?
I was 28. No, I was 27 when I found out. Well, I was 28 when I had him. Right.
Okay.
So for me, honestly, that felt like a teen mum because kids are having... people are having kids so much older now. And I still felt like a baby then. So I felt really young. I felt really unprepared. And the one thing that gave me a sense of comfort was that I was like, no one's ever regretted having kids. No one's ever said, oh God, wish I hadn't.
Yeah.
But everyone's always said it's the best thing that ever happened. Yeah. And I think it's the same with aging. I've never met anyone that's like, oh, it's downhill from there. It's shit after this.
No.
Everyone's always like, it gets better and better. It just does. And I think that I am so with you that I am starting to feel that difference in that, you know, I think it's things like really understanding that things aren't worth worrying about.
Yeah.
It's really knowing that when things go wrong, they'll go right again and like they'll be fine. And that is like, there's a sense of ease and grounding that comes each year. And I think it is kind of magical.
No, you're so right. Like, I don't know, you just learn to not sweat the little stuff as much.
Yeah.
You can't stress about the things you can't control.
Mm.
That's just it. Like I can, you know, work hard and show up on time and learn everyone's name and be the best version of me. But ultimately, like, I might not get that job or that person might not like me or Brenda from Barnsley still might think I'm a slapper. There's just nothing I can do. And I have to stop stressing about what strangers on the internet think or what producers might think or why I didn't get that job or whatever. You know, I've just got to focus on my family, my friends, being the best version of me and making sure when I'm old and grey, I look back on my life and go, yeah, you did it right. You've got memories and moments to look back on and you lived it right. Like, that's all I want. And I think that comes more and more with age, mate. And even though there's certain things we're probably going to struggle with and probably going to miss, don't get us wrong. I haven't even had a kid and I miss my pelvic floor from my 20s.
Vicky, I think you should be an inspirational speaker. Honestly, I'm in awe.
No, Roxy, I am so excited I came to see you today. This is so good for my mental health. I'm having such a nice time. Say more nice things.
Honestly, I'm like, get on stage. The crowd will be fucking buzzing.
I couldn't speak to a room more than this, you know.
No, you could.
I couldn't.
Yes, you could. I'm getting you on stage. Next time I do one of my confidence shows, you're coming on. I just want to talk quickly. You have spoken about freezing your eggs.
Yes.
Again, something I don't think people are talking about as much.
I met Erkan when I was like, I think about 31, 32. It came off the back of a lot of failed relationships and a lot of heartache. And I think you go through a certain amount of that and you start to wonder if the things you wanted are actually for you and if those moments you dreamed about are even going to be possible. And then I met Erk and everything sort of fell into place. But I was very adamant that I wasn't going to rush our timeline. Just to make the things I wanted eventually possible. I wanted us to get to know each other. I wanted us to be sure. I'd had a lot of, like I say, situations not work out the way I'd planned. And like, I know everybody wants different things, but I desperately wanted to be married. I wanted to be loved by a nice man. I wanted to be married. I wanted to have like a nice safe home, dogs, kids, like whatever. I wanted something quite traditional in my head. Mm-hmm. And our relationship was going really well and really smoothly and everything. And I still was just aware that Erk's younger than me by 6 years, which is really worth mentioning. I'm a cougar. I just knew that even though I was in my mid to late 30s and starting to feel certain things, I knew he potentially wasn't. And we talked really openly. We had some great, really honest communication about it all. And I think the line I got from him, which sort of inspired us to freeze my eggs, was, I'll have kids if you want.
Oh, and I was like,
no, I really need you to want this as well. Yeah. You know, like, it's going to be really tough and really hard. And I'm probably going to have to go back to work loads quicker than I would want and blah, blah, blah. You're going to be doing the majority of the childcare. I need you to be in this boat and fucking rowing.
Yeah.
Not just if you want. I'm not willing to rush my timeline just because of societal pressure or this ticking biological body clock or anything. So we made the decision to freeze our eggs. I say our eggs because we've made embryos. They were originally mine.
Right.
our embryos, my eggs.
Yeah.
So I did it at about, I think I might have been about your age, Roxy, 35, 36.
Yeah.
I thought in my head, this is something worth sharing because I know a lot of women who are around my age, who haven't found the perfect partner, have focused on career and are feeling certain pressures, right? And I thought, I'm going to talk about it. I'm going to detail the ups and downs, and just present women with this, like, in my opinion, responsible, different option, alternative, if you will, to fucking just panic shagging somebody and having a baby with them because you think you're in your late 30s. Which, yeah, listen, there's no judgment there either, but it's happened to a lot of me pals, and now they're bringing their kids up on their own, and I think, mm-hmm, oh God, no, I that's so amazing and brave and brilliant, but it's hard, right? So anyway, yeah, so I did it, and I didn't think I was like the patron saint of freezing eggs or anything, and I didn't think everyone was going to be like, woo, but I was still shocked at the backlash I got.
Backlash?
Yeah.
Why?
Oh, it's such a divisive topic.
Is it?
Such a divisive one. And quite rightly so, fertility is sensitive.
Right.
I didn't expect the level of vitriol that it was going to
involve. What were people saying?
He doesn't fucking love you and he doesn't want to have kids with you, so just accept it.
Oh my God.
I mean, it went from the sublime to the ridiculous. I had a lot of people telling me that God didn't want me to have children, which...
Bloody hell.
You know, a lot of like, you're 36 and you've got a fella, why don't you just have a kid?
Right.
Oh, I feel like maybe we might be projecting there. Mm-hmm. It was all just so confusing and hurtful and fucking scary to try and unpack when your intentions had been so good. Mm. I thought it was going to go one way and it absolutely went another, and it was a bit of a roommate.
Was there more of that than there was the, like, thank you for sharing this?
I mean, it's a couple of years ago now, but you know, you always remember the angry and the hate and the negative. There was a lot of support.
Yeah.
But when I was chock full of hormones, mate, synthetic hormones coursing through your veins, and like, I'm very hormonal as is.
Yeah.
So to add like extra fuel to that quite spicy fire was, I was like, oh, ticking time bomb. And I always remember there was this moment, mate, where I come offline. I was about the 7-day mark. And anyone who's gone through this process with IVF or egg freezing will tell you, you go in and get scanned and they see if your eggs are egging, for want of a better word.
Right.
I'm not a doctor.
Right.
But like, if they're not doing what they're meant to be doing and they're not at the stage they want them to be at, you get extra hormones.
Okay.
And I just knew in that moment I was teetering on a knife's edge anyway. Right. And I was like, oh, welcome to the Thunderdome, bitch. And I went home that night and I posted and I got like some really cruel messages and I just thought, I can't do this. Like, I believed what I was doing was right, but for my sanity, I just need to take a step back. Yeah. So I did, and I came off social media. Curiosity got the better of the cat, I think, a couple of days later. And I went on to check my DMs, see if they'd calmed down. And I had this one message off this woman, and like, she'll never know how important she was to me. Mm. She said that she was in her late 30s and that all her friends had kids and they couldn't understand her feeling of longing, but feeling that she wanted to do it with somebody, and you know, all these things. And so she'd started the egg freezing process and she felt so alone and so scared and so misunderstood by everybody. But every night she'd log on Instagram and see me doing me injections, and she felt like she was doing it with us.
Oh.
She felt like she was doing it with a pal. I know. And in that moment, I remembered that I wasn't a fucking weak bitch. And I realised that all the reasons I said I was going to do it were so important, more important to me than the people who didn't understand why I was doing it, because you're never going to please everybody. And like I say, fertility is a very sensitive issue and you have to understand that. So I came back online. Honestly, Roxy, I feel really passionately like these conversations that affect women, these issues that, you know, are often surrounded by stigma and shame and all the rest of it, they do need more sunlight, they do need more candor, and they do need more honest discourse. Because the only way you're going to normalize freezing eggs or normalize surrogacy or normalize reproductive health issues is by talking about them more. I feel really grateful to that woman who commented, and if she's ever listening to anything I've ever done, I just want to say thank you.
Oh, that's so beautiful. And you gave her strength. What an amazing thing.
Women can be great.
They really can. And how long was the whole process for you?
You know, actually, I think that's a real common misconception, mate. People think it's months or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And from actually like my first injection to the retrieval, it's around 2 weeks.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow, yeah, I thought it was
so much longer.
So long.
No, it's really good. I've got a friend doing it at the moment. She's really thriving. She's fine. And again, it's so subjective. You can just tell she feels really empowered by it.
Yeah.
That she's like taking control of her narrative and her timeline and doing something for her. And then she can go out and have that really liberated feeling of like dating who she wants when she wants. You know, absolutely. It's not like this mad panic, which we often feel in our late 30s. So I had ups and downs. And I would encourage anyone who's doing it to give themselves like a bit of kindness, in particular after the retrieval.
Right.
I felt like I'd been hit specifically in me vagina by a car. I did feel like they were like, just take the afternoon off, you'll be fine tomorrow. And like I was like lying in the bath that night and I was like, when all my meds had worn off, and I was absolutely not fine. So if you are going to do it, please do it. It's incredible and empowering and brave and amazing and all the rest of the things, but be kind to yourself as well.
Absolutely.
Because it's not a picnic.
No, no. Well, thank you so much for sharing all that. And so happy for you. What it sounds like is that what you're so great at is doing now is doing life on your terms.
So I'm trying.
Yeah. And I think, and being you and being authentic and showing up as you are, and it has obviously resulted in not only helping so many people, but connecting you with so many people and helping you actually just feel happier, yeah, and more confident. And it's such a beautiful thing to see. It really, really is.
Thank you.
Right. You did a documentary about deepfakes. Now, I haven't watched it yet. I'm so sorry.
Don't apologize. I'm a busy woman.
I know that there was quite a lot of backlash around it.
Yeah.
And I think I would actually just love to learn more about why you did it, what is actually going on with this stuff at the moment? Because I think this whole AI thing is terrifying. Mm-hmm. I think AI can be amazing. I love ChatGPT. I've got fucking hell, it's unreal.
Everyone, but like, they were trying to do my BAFTA's captions on ChatGPT yesterday.
No, no, no. It is. Sorry, I just can't get over it. The problem is you stop thinking for yourself.
Absolutely.
And it's scary. Like some of the things I've been using it for. Recipes, obviously.
Fine.
Yeah. It's been my lawyer recently, which is really fucking great for contracts. It has written bedtime stories for Wolf.
No, you're not farming out the bedtime stories.
And it's my doctor. So I love ChatGPT, I won't lie.
I don't think you're the only one.
Yeah, half people love ChatGPT and the other half are like, I'm never going on that thing.
I fall into the never going on it camp, but that's only because like I'm genuinely convinced that Will Smith's film I, Robot was in fact like a premonition. not just a fun blockbuster. Like I'm absolutely convinced. Like I've even started saying fucking thank you to me microwave mate, because I'm totally convinced they're all just gonna rise up.
Honestly.
And just gonna get chinned off of George Foreman. Like I'm terrified.
So AI, ChatGPT aside, and some of the benefits and some of the ways it can make your work more efficient, it's scary. It's scary that the thought that people can start to impersonate you. Tell me about what deepfakes are. Why you did this documentary? Why was there backlash?
So we made the documentary, we started making it last year, and it was, we decided to make it off the back of some really harrowing statistics. Mm-hmm. Like the number one thing AI was being used for at the time was deepfake porn.
Number one thing?
Yeah, yeah. Taking someone's likeness, which can be done as simply as like getting a picture from social media, whether it's your Facebook, your Instagram, whatever, and creating a naked image can take seconds. There is no consent involved. There is, for the most part, the person, the victim doesn't even know. Mm-hmm. What we discovered as we went further through the documentary is these undressing apps, which is deepfake AI abuse in its most rudimentary form, they actually don't register a man's body. We ran it through with my husband. We put a picture in of him and it gave him traditionally female body parts. Stripped his clothes off, but gave him breasts and a vagina. Because this is not technology designed to torture people, to torment people. This is technology designed to torture women.
Mm.
And we quickly discovered that 99% of those affected are women, you know? And we felt like that, we felt very passionately that this was a subject that was not getting talked about enough, that was not getting enough sunlight, that did not have ironclad legislation surrounding it. In fact, it was not illegal at all to create an image like this. Illegal to share it, to send it to your mates or whatever, but to create it, no laws.
Wow.
So we reached out to victims, we reached out to the police, reached out to large platforms, even perpetrators, reached out to people creating these deepfakes.
Really? How did you get a hold of them?
We found it was through the dark web.
Right.
And we found this one guy and he agreed to chat to us. The way he rationalised it was very scary. He was like, he sort of said, you know, if I don't do it, someone else will. Mm. It was honestly, it was a very dark and quite depressing thing to make. Mm. And understandable when you understand, when you think of the lives it's ruining. We spoke to some victims and women who'd had it done to them. And you just realise, like, how heartbreaking and debilitating having something like this happen to you is. Like, mm-hmm. robbed them of that confidence, like, mm-hmm. made them feel like... And, you know, as women quite often do, almost blame yourself, you know? Like, if I hadn't done this, would it have still happened? If I hadn't put my pictures on social media, if I had worn my hair up and not had it down, if I hadn't been desirable, would this still have happened? It was Potato and Channel 4 who made it. We knew it was divisive.
Why was it?
We created a deep fake sex tape using my image to show how easy it was to do and how easy it was to distribute and how easy it was to spread and basically raise awareness.
Yeah.
And there was a couple of victims who said that they had themselves had this happen to him and they found that triggering.
Right.
There's no part of me that doesn't understand that and doesn't feel incredibly sorry that we caused anybody any upset or pain, especially when they'd already been through so much.
Yeah.
We did have victim testimonials, women who'd had it happen to them, a politician in Northern Ireland, a wonderful family woman from Liverpool, and a newsreader who agreed to be involved and championed what we were doing, things like that. I honestly felt really proud that we'd made something that got a nation talking about mm-hmm. something that was largely going completely unnoticed. I do also understand that there was some backlash as well and there was some pushback, and we do feel really sorry to anyone we've offended. But ultimately, what we're trying to do was get people to foster empathy for those affected by it, because there's still so much misinformation.
Yeah.
I remember one victim of it who reached out to us and told us in my DM, she was like, thank you so much for making this. She went, it happened to me 5 years ago. And the police officer said to me, I should feel it's a compliment. The idea that it's victimless, or the idea that, you know, no one's actually hurt or whatever. It's all so misguided. This is ruining lives. And let's strip it down to what it actually is, right? Deepfake AI abuse. It's the latest iteration in violence against women.
Mm.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
This is what we're having to fight with. You know, you don't know that it's going on. Half the time the victims don't even find out. Like, it's under this cloak of anonymity. It's all just so dangerous and destructive. And no matter how much the police or the authorities or anybody are trying to keep up with it, it needs policing from all angles, right? Because the technology that they're using moves so much faster than the laws ever could. So what we hoped to do with this documentary was campaign for ironclad legislation, mm-hmm. encourage people to foster empathy and compassion for those affected, and also start conversations. As a parent, start having conversations with your children, whether they're boys or girls. Tell young lads that consent is important.
Yeah, yeah.
Teach them it from whatever age, that, you know, no means no, that taking a girl's clothes off in a picture without her consent, that's wrong. If parents aren't aware of this technology, how are they going to have those conversations?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because before I made this documentary, I didn't know what was happening.
Mm.
So there were so many reasons why we made it, and I've made me peace with the reaction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's conversations happening in Parliament about it now. Am I going to take the credit for that? Absolutely not. There's amazing women who've been campaigning for this mm-hmm. so much longer than I even knew it existed, you know. Baroness Charlotte Owen, Claire McGlynn, like, real, real brilliant women who are advocating for change. We were a small part of that.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel strongly that we did make a good film.
Yeah.
And we hopefully are going to help women. I'm sorry that anybody didn't agree, and I understand, but no, I remain really proud of it.
I'm going to share something I've never shared before. I'm really happy that you made this documentary because... Oh my God, my heart is racing.
I feel like I'm going to cry.
No, don't. I mean, you can, but no. When I was 26, I had been on a massive bender, and I woke up next to my best friend, Paula, and like the worst hangover of my life. And I went into my DMs, and on my DMs, I saw somebody had sent me a message, and it was a naked picture of me that I'd taken of myself in the mirror. And I was like, whoa. What the fuck? And I was like, how why is some stranger sending me my own naked picture? Like, and I used to take a lot of naked pictures in the mirror to document my weight growing up because I was obsessed with my weight. Within half an hour, what I realized is that every single naked picture I had ever taken from the age of 21 to 26 was uploaded onto the internet. And there were like hundreds because nobody deletes their photos, right? Your iPhone is like, iCloud is like full. I was mortified. I mean, I was so upset. I was so embarrassed. I was so, it was just, it was so surreal and strange. And I had to remove all comments that mentioned, like, I had to put a filter on, like, boobs, ass, like, all of this. I would get, like, random disgusting men sending me, like, dick pics on my DMs. Like, it was horrible. And I spent, like, thousands of pounds that I really didn't have on lawyers who could obviously do nothing. And then I was trying to, like, find little jobs here and there. And I had finally landed this job. The night before, my makeup artist messaged me being like, the shoot's been cancelled. And the brand rep the next day, she didn't have the courtesy to tell me the day, had said, sorry, we found out about your lead pictures. Oh, I'll tell you how she found out. Because I'd opened up to another woman about it. I'd opened up to a friend that I knew in the industry and was like, this thing happened. She went and told people and they said, we won't work with you because naked pictures of you are on the internet. Even though I hadn't done anything wrong, it's not like I had uploaded them willingly. And even if I had, like, I could if I wanted. And so I really felt at the time, I was in a really bad space anyway, but that really was a catalyst for me kind of sinking a lot further into my depression at the time, my addiction. It was a really horrible time. And I never, ever, ever spoke about it because I didn't want anyone to go searching for them.
I'm really sorry.
It's fine. And look, I'm not the only one. And this is in no way a sob story. I have no feeling around it now. Like, it's just something that happened. But I think that what was sad about it was that my boyfriend, women around me, brands, they really felt like they demonized me for something that was not my control. And so I think that now what was naked pictures being leaked is now going to be naked videos and porn. And so I think the work you're doing with that is so powerful. And I do think people at least need to be able to understand that nobody is asking for it.
No.
Like, if it happens to a victim, they are victims.
Yeah.
You cannot punish women for being themselves.
Yeah. What shocked me when I did it was just like the outpouring of messages I received from people being like, this happened to me. So I got a message from a woman to say, I'm a teacher at an international school in Singapore. We've had 3 cases of this year. Young lads, because the technology is so accessible, just popping a picture of the girl they fancy in school, the teacher who gave them the detention, whatever.
Oh my God.
Popping it in, passing it around, completely removing that woman's right to autonomy and consent. In seconds. And they're marketed like so, marketed in a way that makes you feel like you're buying an app to put filters on a picture.
There's like apps.
Yeah, it's apps, babe. That's how you do it. It's just the latest, it's just the latest in the abuse of women. People will still stop me on the street and say, I watched that documentary with me girls. And I took them straight off social media. I did this, I did that. Like, should it be a woman's responsibility to remove herself from social media? No. But in the interim, when we're teaching young lads, when we're campaigning for harsher laws, when we're trying to change the attitudes around all of these sort of things, like, I just think being aware of the issues and what's happening in the dark space of technology and AI in general, I think being aware is important.
I think what's so amazing is that you've had this such incredible transformation, and it's so amazing to see you thriving. And I can't wait to consume more of you. Get a grip, out now. Yeah. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I don't want to promote a podcast on a podcast.
Fucking do it.
But like, I'm so tacky. But yeah,
please.
If you'd like to listen to me podcast, Get a Grip is good. I got a TV show out in the minute. It's called The Honesty Box. That's really fun.
Yeah, I saw that this morning. Tell me about it.
Babe, it's fun. It's like reality TV dating show with a twist. So, you know, you've got bikini clad babes and tattooed hunks all looking for love.
Yeah.
But we've got the added drama. armor of giant honesty box, which uses like military grade AI technology to spot when someone's lying. Right, is your relationship a showman's? Do you fancy so-and-so? Do you forces people to be honest and really champions authenticity in relationships. So it's a nice one.
Love
a little bit
that.
Spicy as well, I'm not going to lie.
We need a bit of spice.
Got to have a bit of spice.
Vicky, thank you so much for being on Rise with Roxy. Vicky Patterson is proof that who you were doesn't have to define who you become. And it reminds us that rising isn't always graceful, but it is always possible. If her words moved you today, take a moment to think about what version of yourself you're ready to outgrow. And know that you, like Vicky, are allowed to evolve and change and grow. Don't forget that we have bonus episodes now where I'm answering your dilemmas. So if you want to send in yours, you can either send us a DM on the Rise with Roxy account or email us at risewithroxy@bowermedia.co.uk. Until next time, keep rising.